Now, can we turn tonight, please, to the book of Malachi again? And tonight we're reading from chapter 2. And we're going to read into chapter 3. Now, we're really going to consider tonight in the ministry from verse 14 onward of chapter 2. So there'll be four verses there. And then we're going to read right on until the end of verse 12. So we're going to be considering together, if possible, we'll see how the time goes, but if possible, to try and deal with the matters that are written up to the end of verse 12. And then in the will of God, we'll conclude tomorrow night from verse 13 to the end of this little book. So we're going to consider those last verses of chapter 2, that's the last four, but I want to read with you from verse 11 just so that we can get the connection. So we're reading then first from chapter 2, verse 11. Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of the Lord which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. The Lord will cut off the man that doeth this, the master and the scholar, out of the tabernacles of Jacob, and him that offereth an offering unto the Lord of hosts. And this have ye done, again, covering the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and with crying out, insomuch that he regardeth not the offering any more, or receiveth it with good will at your hand. Yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. And did he not make one, yet had he the residue of the Spirit? And wherefore one, that he might speak a godly seed? Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away. For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that ye deal not treacherously. Ye have wearied the Lord with your words, yet ye say, wherein have we wearied him? When ye say, every one that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them, for where is the God of judgment? Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant, whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming? Who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner, and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi, and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. And I will come near to you in judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, and against the adulterers, and against false swearers, and against those that oppress the hireling in his wages, and the widow, and the fatherless, and them that turn aside the stranger from his right, and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts. For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed. Even from the days of your fathers ye are gone away from mine ordinances, and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But he said, wherein shall we return? Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sake, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast their fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts. And all nations shall call you blessed, for ye shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. Now we know that God has promised to bless the reading of his precious word again to us tonight. Now over this week we've been looking together, as most know, at this small prophecy of Malachi. And we've been noticing that it is really God's final message to the nation of Israel before that large period of time, the 400-year gap, would elapse until the coming of John the Baptist and the bringing in of Christ because of the failure of the nation. And so as we attend to this prophecy, we notice that it, in its turn, recalls events that have largely taken place about 80 years after the greatest revival that Israel had ever seen, when God had brought them back from Babylon. And in the midst of all the difficulties of going back, God had brought them back into the land. They had rebuilt the temple. They had re-established the sacrifices and the offerings, as you can see his mention of that in the chapters that we have read. And you would have thought that by now, if God has so re-established them, and there has been such blessing and such a great wave of revival, that there would have been a great spiritual condition. But 80 years have passed, and sad, sad days are now again upon the nation. And you may remember that we have looked and noticed that that is a good parallel for you and I to remember today. You wouldn't, if you look back 80 years now, I don't know anything about the city of Sydney, but I would think that 80 years ago things were very healthy in the assembly, much healthier than they are today. We are living in dark days, right across the world where we live. And so the message of Malachi is a relevant message for us today. Now we looked at chapter 1 and we saw that God spoke to them very clearly in chapter 1 in three sections. And God spoke about the sovereignty of his love for them, despite the fact that they had wandered far from him and had become apathetic, and they had become backslidden in their hearts. The first thing that the Lord Jehovah says to the nation is this: I have loved you. And they say, wherein hast thou loved us? And anyone who questions the love of God is on the road to spiritual ruin. The moment that we fail to appreciate the love that God has for us, well, it shows that we're not living in communion with the Lord. And so that was a mark of their degeneracy. And then we looked at a section where the Lord speaks again to them, not now about the sovereignty of his love, but we saw there was a little section there that dealt with the standards of his service for them. But they had failed those standards, badly failed them. And then the chapter closed with a section where we thought about the supremacy of his name. For he said, you may have despised my name, but I have fixed the day when my name shall be great, and the very heathen will bring their offerings to me. They didn't understand it, but God, through the prophet, was speaking about the millennial day, that wonderful day that's coming, that he shall sit upon the throne of his father David, and his name will be magnified then. So that was chapter 1. Well, last night we looked at chapter 2, but we only looked at the first part of chapter 2. You may remember that what we did was we looked at the first 13 verses, and we saw that the problems, are you listening now, the problems in Israel were really due to this. That what was the state of the people in chapter 1 was because the spiritual leadership had failed in chapter 2. And we said last night, no nation rises higher than its leaders. David said in that closing song of his life, he that ruleth over man must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And no family rises, are you listening? No family rises higher than the leadership that God puts into the home. And no assembly rises higher than the leadership that God has put there. I'm not blaming God, by the way. I mean, it doesn't rise any higher than the leadership that is conducted by those that God has put in place. For God gives man responsibility to act for him. And so we could see last night, I think, that the problem was with the leadership. And the leadership was the priest. For we noted that there had been a period when Israel was under judges. And there had been a period when Israel was under kings, but this is the period when Israel was under the leadership of priests. So now that brings us tonight to the section that we're going to look at now. And I want us to divide the section that we've looked at from verse 14 like this. First of all, we're going to think for a little time from verse 14 to the end of verse 17 about the solemnity of marriage, because you'll see it there. We're going to talk a little about the solemnity of marriage. And then secondly, we're going to turn our attention next to the first four verses of chapter 3. And there we're going to think about the sign of the Messiah. For God had a sign that he was giving to Israel as to when the Messiah would come. The messenger. So verses 1 to 4, the sign of the Messiah. And then we're going to think next about verses 5 to 7. And over that I want us to think about the sovereign who will then be in control and what he will do when he is in control. And finally, we come to a little section from verse 8 to the end of verse 12. And there we're going to think about the secret of blessing. The secret of divine blessing. God, are you listening? God can still open the windows of heaven. But the conditions have to be fulfilled. And there's a secret of blessing in those verses. Now the time will go by very quickly. So let's think first of all about this solemn but important subject of the solemnity of marriage. Now, one thing we noticed last night in verses 11 through to the end of verse 13 was that, listen carefully, although they had gone back into the land, they had reinstituted the sacrifices. The temple was rebuilt. The walls were rebuilt. Or at least they were still in them, possibly in the process of being rebuilt. But the point I want to make is this. It seemed to be largely external, and their hearts were not right with God. Now listen to that. You and I could have everything right in the assembly. Every T could be crossed, and every I could be dotted. But our hearts might not be right with God, and we can't live for blessing if it's like that. Now don't misunderstand me. I believe there should be godly order in every assembly. I believe that with all my heart, the New Testament teaches it. But we've got to remember that we need more than order. We need right conditions as well as right positions. And they seem to be right positionally, but they weren't right conditionally. Their condition was wrong. And it soon seemed to be an evidence. We saw it last night. You know what it was? Are you listening? Their hearts were so worldly that they then looked to the world for their companionship. And it's always a bad thing when the believer looks to the world for his companionship. But it was even more serious than that. It's a bad thing when any Christian looks to the world for his or her companionship. James tells us very plainly in his epistle, you've read it in chapter 4, friendship with the world is enmity with God. 2 Corinthians 6 states it plainly, wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord. Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, but they were entering into an unequal yoke with unbelievers. And it wasn't only earthly friendship, but it was a bond. Are you listening now? They were forming bonds that cannot be broken. For there is a bond in this world that cannot be broken apart from death. That is the bond of marriage. The statements of Romans 7 and 1 Corinthians 7 are very plain and unambiguous. The husband is married to the wife as long as he lives, and vice versa. So that they were entering into a relationship of marriage with the ungodly, a relationship that they could not break. For God recognizes the marriage of men and women, not just men. And so the unequal yoke had been entered into. That's what we looked at last night. But I want you to see now we come even a step further. And we come down the ladder even more in degeneracy. Are you listening carefully? What was happening now in this section that we come to is not merely that they were entering into the unequal yoke, but we find that they were in fact breaking their original relationship with their, some of them in Israel. They had got so mixed up with the nations around them again that they were now forming relationships with other Gentiles in marriage, and it was sometimes men who were already married, and they were dispensing with their original partner and they were marrying another one. Now we'll come to it in a minute, but look how it is dealt with in the passage. We want to go through it verse by verse. And if you look first of all at verse 14, you will see God has said, he has said what that they have committed abomination and treachery. Look at verse 14. God says, but you say, wherefore? And God, why is it that God will judge this? God has said in verse 13 he will judge it. So they say, why should we be judged for this? Now look at the answer. Because the Lord, here's the first thing I want you to notice. The Lord has been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth. I want to talk to you about marriage just for a moment. I specially asked a question in the car when we came here tonight just to check. Now, in Australia, you have the same custom that we have in Great Britain, and every society in some way or other has it. But when a wedding takes place, in England or in Scotland, we would have one man who is called the best man. In other words, he's the chief witness at the wedding, on the male side. And we have someone who is called the bridesmaid. And the bridesmaid is the second chief witness. And when those vows are made, when marriage is contracted, these witnesses listen. And then the person who is conducting, I've done it many a time myself, conducted the wedding, he says to the audience this, to the congregation. He says, I ask you before God and this congregation. And he's asking them to make their vows in the presence of God and in the presence of the congregation. So that there is in fact two witnesses who sign their name on a certificate, as well as the father who are being married. But there is in fact a whole congregation sitting out there, whether it be 10 or it be 100, 200. And they are listening as witnesses. But you know, this verse shows to us the importance of what the man really says, that we so often gloss over more quickly than the other two things. Before God. Did you notice what it said? It said here, The Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth. I believe that this verse shows to us that when a marriage takes place, God listens and listens for the vows that have been made in his presence. There is a vow that God opens his ear to. Every time it is made, it is that vow of loyalty to each other. And the Bible teaches plainly, here it is in this verse, the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth. Against whom, look what it says, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. See, what had happened was this. These men in Israel, they were doing what is happening so often in our day today. We live in a very selfish society. Can't speak for Australia, but I can speak for the society in a general way, certainly my own society. That we live in a very selfish day, when a man will have his wife, and she brings up children, and they have a little home, and then maybe 20 years pass by, and he sees a young woman, and his heart goes after her. And he sets aside the wife who has served him and lived with him and loved him well. And the selfishness of the flesh causes it to go and take another woman. And it's very easy today, are you listening now? It's very easy to go to the law court. And it only needs the passage of time to be able to ratify a divorce. But I want you to notice that this passage says, we're going to come to it again, but look at it just now while we're dealing with it. Verse 16, for the Lord, the God of Israel, saith, and then it tells us who's saying this, that he hateth putting away. That literally can be read, he hateth divorce. So will you remember that God hates divorce? God has said it. We had an old preacher in Scotland years ago who used to say this. He used to say, we as believers, we love to love what God loves. But sometimes we forget to hate what God hates. Are you listening to that? We should look in the Bible to see the things that God hates. It says he hates pride. So we should remember that now and never be proud. It says that he hates the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Now, it never says he hates the Nicolaitans. And it says he hates the deeds of the Nicolaitans. Never says he hates the Nicolaitans. We should learn to hate the doctrine and the deeds of the Nicolaitans. That's another subject. And it says here that he hates putting away. He hates divorce. So we should hate that as well. And we should remember what the Bible is saying here. Now, what they were doing, they were putting their wives away, and then they were marrying some young woman from the Gentile nation. That's why the unequal yoke part was put in first. But look what now what God is saying. Look at verse 15 again. Look at verse 14 again. Why? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet, look what it says, yet is she thy companion. Not she was thy companion. God has not recognized the divorce. Do you listen to that? God says she still is thy companion. God uses the present tense. I know the italics are there, but the grammar of the verse demands that that is how you interpret it. Yet is she thy companion, and the wife of thy youth. And we are learning in this verse what is taught in the other scripture. But I'm not moving too far out of the book of Malachi tonight because of the other things we have to deal with. But I want you to see just, this is a section that is often neglected when we start talking about marriage and divorce. We forget this little passage. But here we have very clearly stated that God recognized the first marriage. Look again at verse, no, not at verse 14, but look at verse 15. And here we're learning another thing. And did not he make one? Who? such your holiness is spoken about. You see, we've got to remember, brethren and sisters, and I want you to listen to this, that when a marriage takes place, God is the main witness. We've seen that in verse 14. But we're learning something else now. God is the main actor on that day. Are you listening? God is the main actor, not the man who performs the ceremony. It says here, did not he make one? It's God who made them one. Away there in that first marriage in, at the end of Genesis chapter 2 in the garden, it was from the Lord that this was ordained, that those two should be one flesh. Some have thought, wrongly and ignorantly, I hope you're going to listen to this now, some have thought that marriage is simply the physical union of two people coming together, and they try to quote a verse like Isaac took Rebecca into his tent. We must not speak like that. Adam and Eve were called one flesh in the garden, but you never read of physical intimacy taking place till chapter 4 verse 1, after they'd fallen taken place, and they were cast out of the garden, and it says, and Adam knew his wife and she conceived. They were one flesh the moment that they were married. You see, if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and I'm going to leave the subject now, there isn't time to stay with it, and I can't deal with the whole subject of marriage and divorce tonight. That would be too big a subject, and we are trying to go on through the book and get it teaching. But I do want to say this, if you look at 1 Corinthians 6, you will find that the apostle uses this language. He says, he that is joined to a harlot, there's physical intimacy, is one body. And he, that is God, said, they shall be one flesh. God never intended two people to become one body unless they had first become one flesh in marriage. For one body is just two bodies coming together in sin. But one flesh declares the state of marriage, which is a permanent thing. Now, it's not my subject to deal with the whole matter. I'm not evading anything. I'll gladly talk to anybody at the end about it. But I just want us to notice the solemnity of marriage that is taught. Now, with young believers in the meeting tonight, I just want to remind you, any friendship that you form that will eventually result in marriage, remember it for life. We're living in a day when the values of men have set aside the standards of the Word of God. The sins of Romans 1 are openly practiced, I'm told, in Sydney, as they are in London and in San Francisco. But God so condemns it. What the law allows, are you listening now, what the law allows doesn't mean that God allows. Men have flouted the law of God today and legalized things that God has judged and will not permit. So it is with the faith and the sanctity and the permanency of marriage. When they asked the Lord Jesus the questions in the Gospel of Matthew, you know, he asked them a question back. He said, well, what did Moses say? And then they told him. And then he said this, Moses, for the hardness of your heart permitted you, but I say unto you. I don't think, brethren and sisters, that Moses was really allowed of God to do what he did. That was just what Moses allowed. But the Lord took him back to the garden, took him back to the garden, and showed the permanency that God stamped upon marriage at the beginning of this world history. And when you come to 1 Corinthians 7 and Romans 7, which is the final word in the unfolding revelation of the New Testament, the permanency of marriage is doctrinally established in those epistles. But it's a large subject, and I'll leave it there. I just want you to notice as we leave that section, because we must leave it soon. For, look at verse 15. Well, I should say, first of all, you notice that verse 15, did he not make one? God makes one. Yet had he the residue, yet had he the excellency of the Spirit, this was a spiritual union. One Spirit, you see, you'll find that in 1 Corinthians 6. And why one? That he might seek a godly seed. God never intended the loose morals of the world, but he wanted godliness to mark the seed and the continuing line in his purpose. And you can see it says, therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with against the wife of his youth, for the Lord, Jehovah, The God of Israel says that he hates us before. He hates us putting away. For one covereth violence with his garment. Things are covered by men as with a garment. Therefore take heed to your spirit that ye deal not treacherously. But they had wearied the Lord with their words. That's what it says in verse 17. Yet ye say, wherein have we wearied him? God says, and you say, everyone that doeth evil is good. You looking at it? That verse has to do with our subject that we've been looking at. You see it there in verse 17? God says, this is what wearies me. When you say the thing is evil, when you say the thing that I say is evil is good. Well, the world is saying today, it's good if they've got an incompatible relationship. And in the divorce is far better, it's good. But God says it's evil. And God says, you're wearying me with words like that. When you say what is evil is good. And he delighteth in them. Is good in the sight of the Lord. And he delighteth in them all. Where is the God of justice? And that's the last little thing that it brings us to our new section. They say, well, where is the God of judgment anyway? If we were doing wrong, surely God would come in judgment. Heard men say that, haven't you? That's the argument of Peter in 2 Peter 3. Where is the promise of his coming? All things continue as they are. God hasn't acted in judgment, so everything must be all right. That's a bad premise to depend upon. Now come to the next section. And we're going to think now for a few moments, not about the solemnity of marriage, but we're going to think next now about this matter of the sign of the Messiah. Now you'll see the reference that is here, first of all, in the beginning, in the early part of chapter 3. And first of all, we have the promise, behold, I will send my messenger. Now we have noticed that this is a book of messengers. Let me just remind you of it. Malachi's name means a messenger. And when God sent Malachi, he was the messenger of the Lord to the nation of Israel at that time. God needs messengers, you know. He does need messengers. And you don't have to be a great preacher to be his messenger. But you need to know his message. Listen now. You need to know his message. And God had messengers in this book. Malachi was one messenger. Chapter 1, verse 1. But then we saw in verse 7 of chapter 2, the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should keep the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. So we have the second messenger of the book, the priest. The leaders of the people, they are the messengers. You remember we applied it last night and we saw the elders in the assembly. He must be asked to teach. He's got to be the messenger of the Lord of hosts in the assembly. But then I want you to notice now when we come to chapter 3, verse 1, we've got another messenger. And God says, behold, I will send my messenger. So we've got to try to answer the question now, and certainly ask it, who is this messenger? Well, this is John the Baptist. You've only got to see and read this verse carefully and compare it with Isaiah 40 to see that God was going to send a messenger. But look what it says, I will send my messenger and he shall prepare the way before me. Before Jehovah himself would come, there would be one who would come to herald his coming. Now you know that when you turn to the Gospel by Luke, these very words are quoted concerning the Baptist, my messenger whom I send before my face. So that rugged man who lived in the wilderness in the desert places clothed himself, you remember, in such an unusual way, fed upon an unusual diet. This man who preached so fearlessly at the banks of Jordan was the messenger that God sent. You know, of course, don't you, that Matthew talks about it. And you know that Matthew is the gospel of the king. And every king in the East, particularly, he had a herald who would go in front of him. Even in the great royal processions that we sometimes see in London, you know, there would be an official messenger who would go in front and announce that the queen is coming. You see the idea? God sent a messenger. and he stood at the door of the men of the temple. Behold, I send my messenger before my face. Well, here it says, he shall prepare the way before me. But look what it says next. Now, come, I want you to notice this. And the Lord, whom ye seek, shall suddenly come to his temple. So the Lord is going to come. And the messenger will announce that the Lord is going to come. But look what it says. And the Lord whom ye seek. Now that's who Israel was seeking. They were looking for the Messiah, the sent one of God. Look what it says. It says, he shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant. Now this is not the first messenger of the verse. The first messenger is John the Baptist. But the first messenger is coming to proclaim that the messenger of the covenant, the one in whom all Israel delighted in, he would come. This is the Messiah. This is Christ. You say, well, he came, didn't he? Well, of course he came. And you say to me, and John the Baptist did announce that he was coming. And he did. But you see, brethren and sisters, now listen carefully. This is very important to the understanding, I believe, of this passage. And of many Old Testament texts. That what no Israelite ever knew was this. That Christ would come. That Christ would be rejected after those years of his ministry. That Christ would die. That the nation of Israel would have heard the message, but would have rejected it and would have said away with him. And the one who came to be the deliverer and the redeemer of Israel would be rejected and despised of men. But Isaiah 53 forecasted, of course, and so on. But the Israelites didn't understand that. You know the words of the eunuch who was a proselyte of Israel in Acts 8. He said, of whom speaketh the prophet this? Of himself or of some other man? He had no idea that it had to do with Christ the Messiah. No idea at all. And you still speak to a Jew today, and he can't explain Isaiah 53. It's one of the problems he really has. Some say it was Jeremiah, some of them. Others say it's a picture of the nation. But they never think of the Messiah when they read Isaiah 53. They never realize there would be a suffering Messiah. They were looking for a reigning Messiah. What they didn't know, that they were going to say away with him. And when they said away with him, God was going to set the nation aside. For how long? Well, I don't know how long. But it's nearly 2,000 years it's been so far. And maybe the Lord will come tonight and the period will be over. And you're listening and God will resume his dealings with Israel again. But God is not dealing with Israel as a nation today. He set them aside. But they haven't stumbled that they should fall. God is going to recover them. They're going to come in one day. But God is dealing with the church. This is the church age. Now you listen carefully. What I'm trying to show you is this. You can't find the church age in the Old Testament. So it's just as though it's continuous prophecy when you read some of these verses. And really when you come to this verse, this messenger is going to come to his temple. That's not Christ coming to the temple. When he came into the temple in the days of his flesh, this is the day when Christ will come in mighty manifestation. When the church age is over and the church has been raptured to heaven, and the days of great tribulation will come, and when they're over, and when Israel is crying to God for deliverance from foes on the left and foes on the right, and foes in front and foes behind, and she has no way to look, she's being pressed in, then she'll see the sign of the Son of Man coming across the heaven. That's when the messenger is going to come to his temple. What a wonderful day it's going to be. He'll suddenly come to his temple. The Lord, if I understand the Gospel of John aright, he came to the temple twice anyway, and he drove them out twice. There was nothing sudden about it. But it's going to be sudden when he comes the next time. And look what it says. It says, this is the one you delight in. This is the one you're looking for. He'll come. And you think it's going to be a wonderful thing when he comes. Are you listening? You think it's going to be a wonderful thing when he comes. He's saying, God is saying to Malachi, to the nation. But listen to what I'm going to say to you now, God says. Verse 2. That you may abide the day of his coming. who may abide but there at his coming. Who shall stand when he appeareth? For he's going to come like a refining fire. And he's going to come like a full of soap. He's going to burn up the dross of the nation. And he's going to cleanse the refinement of the nation. Now you see, if we only had Malachi, it would be a bigger puzzle to us. But we've got a little help on this. Just on account of now, we've got help from Zechariah. And the closing chapters of Zechariah teach to us that the day is coming when Christ shall come. And when his feet touch the Mount of Olives, you know what he's going to do? But first of all, he's going to reveal himself to the nation. I want to talk to you just for a brief moment. We'll never get to those later sections. We'll just have to finish it all tomorrow night. But this is a lovely thing for us to think about. Do you remember Joseph? Do you remember those days when Joseph experienced when he'd been down in Egypt? And he's down in Egypt and he's been suffering, but now he's the Lord of Egypt, you remember? And isn't it amazing now that his brothers come after the time of trial and out of their tribulation? If you picture for us the days of, wonderful picture of the days of the great tribulation, and they'll come in their knees, and they'll come down to Egypt for help. And you remember what Joseph did? He didn't reveal himself to them. And you know what he did? He waited, and he listened, and he asked questions of them. And one day he said to them, remember the day that he said this to them? I'm going over the story quickly. Do you remember what he said? He said to them one day, have you got another brother? And they had to admit there was another brother. And then he asked them about him. And then he said, well, bring him down with you. Now listen to what they said on one occasion. They said, but it would break our father's heart. Hey, listen to that. They said, it would break our father's heart. I think that's the time when Joseph must have gone in and wept. He thought back down the years, you know. Thought of the day when Joseph, you remember what it says of Joseph in Genesis 37? Israel loved him more than all his brethren. He was a special object of his father's love. They didn't think about his father's heart that day. They took his garment. They dipped it in the blood of an animal. And they went to the old man and they said, some beast must have eaten him. And they didn't care a bit about the father's heart. They were hard-hearted then. But he's got them now in Egypt. And he can see their hearts are different now. They think more about the father. There's a change. And it's after all that that he revealed himself to them. That's what it's going to be in that coming day. You know what it says when he comes and sees whom? They gaze upon him whom they fear. And then it says, they shall weep. Every family and every house and every tribe apart. There'll be a mourning and a weeping in Israel. And they're gazing upon the wounds of Christ and they'll say, that's when Isaiah 53 will be fulfilled. They'll say, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. You see, a wound upon him. And with his stripes, we are healed. What a wonderful day it's going to be. And he'll reveal himself to the next. And you know what it says next? I'm summarizing some of these sections at the end of Zechariah. You've got it in your Bible. You read it, no doubt, from time to time yourself. You know what it says? Then there'll be a fountain open for sin and unclean. And they'll be washed. They'll be cleansed. And they'll be renewed. And they'll be blessed. You see what God is saying? He's going to come as a refiner. The fire will burn up the dross. And they'll admit that they put him to the cross. And they'll admit that they were wrong. And they'll repent in his presence. And then they'll be cleansed at the fountain. Not only is he a refiner, but it says, look, he's like the full of soap, the cleansing for them. And it says, he shall sit as a refiner and purify of silver, and he'll purify the sons of Levi. All these sons of Levi with all their sin and treachery and evil, all the sin that permeated the nation will be taken away forever, and God will have a cleansed and a regenerated and a renewed nation upon earth. You know, we sometimes only speak out of selfish sometimes, don't we? We think only of our blessings and the fact that we have been crowned and that we have been blessed and we are going to see Him, and all this is wonderfully true, and we'll have seen Him long before this. Oh, I believe the rapture is going to take place any moment, and He's going to come and take us home to the Father's house, and we'll enjoy His presence for long years before this ever takes place. But at least 7 years after the rapture, this is going to be happening. And what a wonderful day it's going to be. He will sit as a refiner, and He will purify those sons of Levi and purge them of gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Malachi says, but you see, it's almost as though it's going to happen just any minute, the way he's writing, because the gap of prophecy can't be understood till you come to the New Testament. Can you see the continuity of things? So you read a bit about the old and a bit about the new. But in fact, it's just like continuous prophecy if you take the gospel out. You follow what I'm trying to get at? And I want you to see with me, brethren and sisters, that it says, and they'll offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Look at verse 4. Then shall the offering of the Lord be blessed, of Jerusalem and Judah be pleasant to the Lord. God has said, so that we've read it, I'm weary with you, God has said. I can't do with all this hypocrisy in you. And the offerings you're bringing me, you're just bringing grief to my heart. But it says, then the offering, it will be pleasant. And the Lord says, and it's as in the days of old, as in the former years. Now, I'm not going to attempt to talk to you about the secret of blessing, but I do want to talk to you very briefly about that little question, because it will only take me a moment or two. I just want to talk to you very, very briefly now about that little section that comes in from verse 5 through to verse 7. And we'll think just for a moment about that day when the sovereign will be in control. You see it there in verse 7? And I will come near to you, the judgment. And I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers. You see, there'll be those who will have taken the mark of the beast. And there'll be those who will have refused the mark of the beast. And God is saying there will be judgment for those. And against the adulterer, and against the false swearer, and against those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow, and the fatherless, that turn aside the stranger from his right and fear not me. For I am the Lord, I change not. That's why you sons of Jacob are not consumed. You see, brothers and sisters, God could have wiped them out, couldn't he? Look what they did. They rejected him, and they rejected him, and they rejected him again and again. And now what have they done? They've put his own son to the cross, and have nailed him there, and have seen him crucified, and have rejected the one who came to bless them. And God says the sons of Jacob are still not good. You know why? You know why, brothers and sisters? God made a promise to Abraham. Hey, listen to this now. There are people who call themselves amillennialists. And they call themselves that because they believe there isn't going to be a day of manifested glory when Christ will reign in reality upon earth. I believe with all my heart that if there were four kingdoms in Daniel chapter 5, then I believe there were five kingdoms there. Sorry, Daniel chapter 2. And if there are four beasts which depict kingdoms again in Daniel chapter 7, I believe that there are five, and so do you, I'm sure. Because there's a fifth kingdom in chapter 2. And there's a fifth kingdom in chapter 7. Now listen, no one ever argues that the first four were real, literal, tangible kingdoms. No one ever argues that point. But what they say is this. The fifth is going to be spiritual. Doesn't make good the interpretation, does it? If the first four were literal, it makes plain sense to see that the next one will be literal. There's going to be a literal kingdom. And Jesus will reign on earth. We think that Jesus shall reign wherever from, though his successive journey run. This is the day that he's spoken about. And God is saying, that's why the sons of Jacob are not consumed. I promise that he shall sit upon the throne of his glory. I made promises to Abraham, and by seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And if God consumed, are you listening? If God consumed the sons of Jacob, he couldn't keep the promise he made to Abraham. That's why he loved Jacob and hated Esau. There's nothing in Jacob that was said that we saw the other night. There was not much dispute between them. You remember we saw that? Esau sold his birthright. Jacob sold the blessing. Wasn't much dispute between them. But God made promises, and they're going to be fulfilled. I thank God for the day coming when the wounded man will sit upon the throne of his glory. Men will see him, and men will delight in him. You know where you and I will be? We'll be just with him when he comes. We're coming. How can we come out of heaven in Revelation chapter 19? How can we come out of heaven? You know why? Because we'll have gone into heaven at the rapture. And when we come out, we'll have been in there with him for a long time. But we're coming out when he comes. You see, those in white clothes and white linen that accompany him, that's the white linen which is the righteous message of the saints. It says it earlier in the chapter. That's what we get at the judgment seat of Christ. You've heard someone say, haven't you, that we are weaving now what we wear then. Every time as you did, Hebrews 6 verse 10 says so clearly, God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. What we do for him now is all being woven into that lovely garment we wear in display glory. Is it in any of the other epistles? Well, Colossians 3 says, your life is now hid with Christ in God. But listen to what it says next. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, the word is shall be manifested, that's the day of his manifestation, then shall we appear with him. Then shall we be manifested with him in glory. So when he comes, we are coming. That's why it says, of course, again in 1 John chapter 2, the very same truth. And that's why it says in 2 Thessalonians 1, the very same truth. It says, then he'll be glorified in his son. And he'll be magnified, admired rather, in all that believe. But a wonderful day is coming, aren't they? And they're not all in the New Testament spoken of, they're in the Old. And this last little book that's talking about the degeneracy of the nation and departure from God, it's also talking about the glory that God is going to invest, thank you, in the coming day. And the apostle, the writer, the prophet says, and where did I close now? From the days of your fathers you have gone away, and you have turned away from mine ordinances, and you haven't kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto thee to you. But listen, after all that, see what it says? We're closing with it. I'm reading verse 7 of chapter 3. But he said, wherein shall we return? Everything that God said there is the question of God. Isn't it? We trust that God will help us to be encouraged by his word. And if we can get a grasp of prophecy, you see, I've heard Christians say, I knew some very great men that I admired and was greatly helped by. But we had one or two in Scotland who used to say this years ago. They said, we never ever talk about prophecy. They said, there's too much disagreement about it. And they said, it's something that we feel we should be practical and we should minister the Sunday truth, and there were good men ministering that. But what they forgot was this. And I say it with all due respect to them. They forgot that all these things were spoken to a very young assembly in Thessalonica. And if you read 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, you'll read that Paul said when he talked about the man of sin and the temple and going into the temple of God, showing himself to be as though he was God. He said, don't you remember I told you these things when I was with you? These things are for us to enjoy tonight and to live in the good of. We've got a God that has us to be in control. Nothing's outside of his hand now. Oh, we know that he's allowing the world to lie in the wicked one at the present time. But it's all in his hand. And the devil can't do a thing outside of the standard he's been given. Let's take courage. Because Christ is coming to take us home. But let's also enjoy this other truth. That Christ is coming to earth to be glorious.